and the light. These were John Steinbeck's goals as he set out at the age of 58 in September 1960 to rediscover the country he had been writing about for so many years. With Charlie, his French poodle, Steinbeck drives the interstates and the country roads, dines with truckers, encounters bears at Yellowstone, and old friends in San Francisco. Along the way, he reflects on the American character, racial hostility, the particular form of American loneliness he finds almost everywhere, and the unexpected kindness of strangers. Travels with Charlie in Search of America, weekdays at noon and replayed overnights at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read and travel by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 73 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1. Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
This is Jack. Here are some articles from the May-June issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor: Keeping Up with Ball by Hunter Hawk. There are many folks I described as my friends. They were inclusive high school and college editors, loving family members who always offered words of encouragement, and intelligent friends who blessed me regularly with unfiltered opinions. If I'm completely honest, though, my most powerful early role model and mentor was Robert Duvall. Legend and very funny, of course. This was a one-way relationship. It involved my hanging on every kind of
1994 film, The Paper. Duvall played a cranky, pragmatic editor-in-chief named Bernie White, always the voice of hard-earned wisdom in his newsroom. At one point, his character is forced to level a satisfied staffer, played by Glenn Close, who had stopped by to beg for a substantial raise. The people we cover, we move in their world, but it is their world, he tells her, with the effect of a gut punch. You can't live like them. You'll never keep up. Now, The Paper isn't anything close to a Western. I bring it up primarily to speak to an insurance company, Duvall himself, since he's now gracing CNI's cover for a fifth time. He is an actor's actor who imbues every performance with a spirit that can't be broken. A wisecracking cowboy, a troubled musician, a bomb consigliere, or a napalm-loving lieutenant colonel, Duvall totally inhabits a role. That's why I believed his character in The Paper so deeply. Through his expert on-screen work, we come to understand worlds that might be far from our own. Putting together a magazine is a lot like that. The worlds we share in these pages might be new and different, but they are by no means off-limits. Anyone who frequents national parks or takes in a local rodeo on a Saturday night can attest that Westerners delight in collective experiences. But even if you can't chase those experiences in person right away, you can have them vicariously through the writers who move in these worlds on our behalf. Check out Rhonda Reinhart's date with mindfulness
at Miraval Austin in the Texas Hill Country. Jesse Huey's quirky introduction to fly fishing on the Texas Gulf Coast. Or Jordan Rain's father-son rafting adventure in Colorado. It is important to us at CNI that our writers inhabit their stories and make a connection. Beyond simply reading their pieces, we want you to feel them. These are challenging times in the West and the world at large. We are grateful we can still share beauty, humanity, and rich culture. The West belongs to
all of us.
A Western storefront.
Big Bend Saddlery. For generations, Alpine, Texas has been a mecca for working cowboys who live off the land. Rock formations peppered with sagebrush and prickly pear cactus blossoms are common scenery in this picturesque West Texas town. Big Bend Saddlery has been a cornerstone of the ranching community in Alpine since at least 1905. Gary Dunshee, current owner of Big Bend Saddlery, specifies at least because the origin of the saddle shop is approximated by its newspaper ads, the earliest known examples of which date to 1905. Famous for handmade saddles, the shop's makers have created custom saddles for the likes of Tom Selleck and Charlie Daniels. Dunshee says among many legendary Western heroes and horsemen. The shop itself has changed with the times over the last 115 years, most recently with an addition that doubled the size of the store. While the storefront has continued to evolve aesthetically, the values within its walls have not. Our number one concern is working cowboys over everything else, Dunshee says. We will drop everything to get those guys back in the business as soon as possible. The legacy of the working cowboy is prominently displayed around the store, even on the ceiling, which features enlarged images of ranchers through the decades from pictures that have been collected by staff and donated by customers. With the influx of visitors to the Alpine area, a curiosity for the Western lifestyle is brewing, prompting new faces to visit the historic saddle shop to learn about an oft-forgotten way of life. Through Western relics, photos, and a hands-on approach to leatherwork, visitors walk away with a tangible experience. Big Bend Saddlery, 2701 U.S. Highway 90, Alpine, Texas, 432-837-5551, online at bigbendsaddlery.com. Here's an anniversary for you. Bolan at 100. Started by a Swedish immigrant with dreams of the Wild West, the Bolan Company has become a touchstone throughout its century in the Western accessories business. By Linda Welchel. It all started in the Wild West, Cody, Wyoming, to be exact. At the time, just a few years shy of the era known as the Roaring Twenties, Cody was a frontier town located on the fringes of Yellowstone National Park. The area's wide open ranges and rivers were teeming with wildlife, and Cody's dusty streets were filled with cowboys, one of whom was named Edward H. Bolan. Bolan followed the long-trodden path of a typical American dreamer by immigrating to the United States from Sweden at just 15 years old. He landed in New York City, but the call of the West quickly drew him out across the plains. It wasn't long before he was a Western horse-riding, cattle-herding cowboy through and through. Bolan opened a leather shop in Cody in 1920 that began the Bolan Company, a luxury buckles and accessories brand celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. Perhaps it's fitting that a story about becoming a cowboy in the Wild West would also be a tale of making it big in Hollywood. That's exactly what happened for Bolan. Life's twists and turns led Boland to take up a second career as a performer in a Wild West show headed to California. There he befriended movie cowboy Tom Mix. It was reportedly Mix who convinced Boland to try his hand at staying in Los Angeles, relocating his shop there to supply his work to the movie industry. In the decades that followed, Boland would become known for his beautifully intricate leather and silversmith work, designing buckles, saddles, gun holsters, and more for many of the brightest Western stars of the silver screen, as well as notable figures off-screen. One of my earliest childhood memories is Hopalong Cassidy. I had a little cowboy hat, the vest and the gun, the boots. Roy Rogers, the Lone Ranger, and Gene Autry, they were my childhood heroes, Boland Company CEO Dave Merrill says, speaking from the present-day company headquarters in Dallas. I grew up watching them, and to be part of that and be in charge of maintaining the legacy of my childhood heroes, protecting that and trying to teach people about it going forward is special. I'm trying to keep the West alive in the minds of the younger generation. Merrill bought the Boland Company in 1999, effectively saving it from a period of upheaval resulting from multiple changes of ownership and struggle following Boland's death in 1980. Merrill said he feels a responsibility to keep the glory of the company alive, but he's quick to add that the brand speaks for itself in its staples of artisanship, quality, and prestige. Those childhood heroes of Merrill's, such as John Wayne and Rogers, all sported Boland designs in their time, but the legacy reached far beyond movie sets. Ed Boland rode in his first Tournament of Roses parade in 1924, and by 1939, a majority of the parade's equestrians outfitted their mounts in stunning tack built by Boland, which were seen by millions of TV viewers each year. Over the years, designs under the brand have become coveted, with many taking top dollar at auction. A Boland saddle from the Lone Ranger television show sold for more than $150,000 in 2018, and the Boland saddle for Rogers' famous horse Trigger sold for more than double that amount. The reputation of the Boland brand has persisted, and today business is thriving. According to Merrill's son Doug, who helps run the outfit, the Boland Company doesn't just owe its longevity to the brand's eminence, they owe it to the customers. For us, it's a testament to what Edward Boland did, who he was, and it's also a testament to our customers, because obviously we wouldn't be here without them. And we have some of the best customers in the world. Boland's fans still include celebrities and top business figures, but also everyday hard-working cowboys and cowgirls. It's the Western lifestyle that ties them together. It's an honor to be in the Western industry because we have some of the nicest, most honest, incredible people that we can get the opportunity to work with every day. The main focus of retail these days is belt buckles, trophy buckles, and modest dressed pieces alike, still made with innate silver and gold carvings typical of the brand, and still done the old-fashioned way with the long-honed talent of silversmiths who've been with the company for years. Some of Boland's artisans even moved with the company from California to Texas in 2005. Beyond the buckles, engraved money clips and jewelry have become a hit for the company, which incorporates its history into each piece. Part of what makes our company so cool is that the steel dies and equipment that made the original buckles are still used by the company today, Merrill says. In other words, a buckle made in the shop today could be cut from the same die as the buckles adorning your favorite Western heroes. We create with the same technology and equipment from the 1930s, Merrill says. We like to work with clients to design an heirloom quality piece that represents the heritage of their family. This is the legacy that we protect. This is what Bolin means to me. To celebrate 100 years in business, this year's anniversary, Buckles will incorporate innovative 3D designs never before seen in the buckle industry, according to Merrill. The pieces will also boast a special engraving of a vintage football-shaped Bolin hallmark used from the 1930s through the 1950s in place of the current company hallmark. Merrill anticipates they'll produce about 800 special anniversary buckles this year. To him, time has flown toward this significant milestone. I still can't fathom the fact that the company is 100 years old, Merrill says. All it means is that we've done a lot of things right for a long period of time, and I think if Ed was here today, he would be very pleased with where the company is. And where Bolin is, it appears, is still close to the hearts of those who love the West. Here's a short historical article about Francis Dinsmore. Thanks to early photographers, we know what the frontier looked like. And thanks to Francis Dinsmore, we know what it sounded like. By Jeff Williams. The Dinsmores were among the first settlers in Red Wing, Minnesota, a small settlement along a far northern stretch of the Mississippi River, where Native Americans and westward-moving pioneers were essentially living side by side. As a young girl, their daughter Frances would lie awake in bed in her family's frontier cabin, listening to the beating drums of the Dakota tribe from a nearby island. As the rhythmic sounds drifted across the quiet waters into her moonlit room, she was not frightened by them, but was instead drawn to them. She would later write that the experience shaped the rest of her life. Born in 1867, Dinsmore grew up to tirelessly devote herself to a singular mission, working to preserve historic Native American culture with a particular focus on the music by collecting as many original recordings as possible from authenticated sources and well-credentialed performers she would find through the copious amounts of travel and first-hand conduct with many tribes in North America. Assisted at times only by her sister Margaret and young native interpreters, she worked for more than 50 years, from the turn of the century up until the mid-1950s. Before she died in 1957, she had completed thousands of well-documented recordings of unique, original, and historically significant Native American music, using the finest recording equipment available at the time, phonographs that utilized a wax cylinder. Formally educated in music at Oberlin Conservatory in Ohio, Dinsmore was essentially self-taught as an ethnologist. In addition to becoming a master recording technician and producer, and a highly skilled ethnologist and historian, she was also a frontier photographer, taking her cameras everywhere to capture supporting photographs. Along the way, she also accumulated a large collection of Native American artifacts. During the most productive portions of her career, from 1907 to 1934, Dinsmore was employed by the Smithsonian Institute's Bureau of American Ethnology, BAE. In addition to making, cataloging, and documenting the recordings, she also wrote prolifically for them, publishing 20-plus books and more than 100 articles. All the materials, photos, recordings, documentation, and property were routinely shipped back to Washington, D.C., and into the capable hands of the BAE at the Smithsonian for archiving. Many of the performers in Dinsmore's recordings were highly placed individuals within Native American communities. She considered her subjects astute observers of human character and behavior, recognizing that any false intentions would be quickly detected and dismissed. She insisted on not trying to adopt cultural affectations, feigning customs, dress, mannerisms, etc., in an attempt to find favor and gain acceptance. Dinsmore universally and unapologetically greeted Native American communities as exactly what she was, a middle-aged Midwestern woman in a long Victorian dress. Take it or leave it, Dinsmore was there to work. In their noteworthy volume, Travels with Frances Dinsmore, University of Nebraska Press, 2015, biographers Joan M. Jensen and Michelle Wick Patterson describe personal notations from Dinsmore's later years that emphasize her desire to be remembered for her professional accomplishments alone. She had her personal correspondences destroyed after her death. She specifically mentions wanting to be recognized as an expert and noted authority in her field of Native American music. Between 1941 and 1943, she was consultant to the National Archives and established the Smithsonian Dinsmore Collection of sound recordings of American Indian music. Today, the bulk of Dinsmore's work lies not at the Smithsonian, where it was originally accumulated, but in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, which has digitized many of her recordings. Search under Frances Dinsmore at the Library of Congress site, loc.gov, and among the results you'll find a transfixing 1916 image of her sitting next to a cylinder recorder with Piegon Indian Mountain Chief of the Montana Blackfeet, who is listening to a cylinder recording of a song, ready to interpret it in sign language to Dinsmore. To hear the bygone sounds for yourself, select any of her recordings. Take, say, the mesmerizing cylinder recording of Louise Pigeon singing in the Menominee language a song called Manibus Tells the Ducks to Shut Their Eyes, documented by Dinsmore in Keshena, Wisconsin in 1925, it might just transport you to a moonlit night with music wafting on the breeze across the Midwestern frontier. The Smithsonian Folkways Collection, Healing Songs of the American Indians, compiles Dinsmore's recordings of medicine men from different tribes singing and chanting songs delivered to them in dream by external powers and spirits that they used to heal the sick. It is available on folkways.si.edu to download or to order as a custom CD. Here's a travel article entitled 72 Hours in Aspen. One weekend is more than enough time to shop, snack, and après-ski, by Emily C. Laskowski. Aspen is a life to live, sings John Denver. See how much there is to give? The longtime Aspen resident wrote profusely of his sunshine and snowcaps prevalent in the posh playground of his adopted home state. And though Denver lived there most of his life, Aspen offers just as much enchantment to visitors passing through for a jet-setting weekend, no matter which season. After C and I stopped in for a whirlwind visit, we asked some of the locals to help us chart an easy guide to basking in the Aspen glow for a few days. Stay. The Gant. How do you prefer to wind down after a day of shopping or skiing? Two words, hot tub. Louis Eppelsheimer, the Gant Sales and Marketing Director. Bonus, there are two heated outdoor swimming pools and three jetted hot tubs for much-needed relaxing at the end of the day. But at the Gant, an Aspen institution since 1973. It's the pampered updates and commodious size of the bedrooms, bathrooms, and living spaces, a modern luxury on group trips that make these spacious condos at the base of Aspen Mountain worth staying at with your closest pals. GantAspen.com. C. Aspen Art Museum. What ultimately differentiates Aspen from other destination communities in the West is the way in which global arts and culture are inherent to its sustainability. Kristen Ann Janiszewski, Aspen Art Museum Communications Director. Plan your visit. Through September 13th, multidisciplinary artist Marin Hassinger presents galvanized wire rope sculptures and concrete works that mimic the outdoors in her exhibit, Nature, Sweet Nature. With a view of Aspen Mountain in the background, the museum's roof deck sculpture garden plays host to seemingly windswept wire vines and planters scaled to human size. AspenArtMuseum.org. Shop. Kimo Sabe. We hear a lot of exclamations about how much Aspen has changed over the years. Actually, I don't feel that way at all. I still see Aspen in the same way it was in the 1970s when I opened my first store before Kimo Sabe. Way ahead of any other place I've ever visited in what makes Aspen, well, what makes us Aspen? Swagger. Tom Yoder, Kimo Sabe owner. More swagger. After you peruse and pose in front of the Aspen store's braggadocious hat wall, visit the Western retailer's other outposts in Las Vegas and Vail, Colorado. KimoSabe.com. Ski or summer? Ski. Buttermilk Mountain. Buttermilk Mountain is so fun and my favorite place to instruct and ski. It has a learning-based terrain park for those who are beginners and some black diamonds for those who really want to get after it. Plus, the views from the cliff house are unparalleled. You can see Highlands Peak and Pyramid Peak. Xanthe Dimas, Aspen Ski Company. The winter ski season generally starts in early December and ends in early April. Visit AspenSnowMass.com to plan your next ski trip. Summer. The Maroon Bells. We are just as busy here in the months of June, July, and August as we are in the winter, says Tucker Vest Burton from Aspen Skiing Company. For an easy day hike, she recommends visiting Maroon Bells, two of the most photographed mountains in North America, and hiking from there past Maroon Lake and on to Crater Lake for a scenic and intermediate-level trail experience. AspenSnowMass.com. Sip. Ajax Tavern at the Little Nell. One of our regular Ajax Tavern guests, who skis practically every day, loves to have Veuve Clicquot on the patio. At Aspen Snowmass, if you ski 100 days in one season, you get a commemorative 100-day pin. The 10th consecutive year that he earned his 100-day pin, he decided to celebrate over a presqu'île by ordering 100 bottles of Veuve Clicquot yellow label champagne, which he lined up across several tables and shared with his friends and their friends. Grant Barrett, the Little Nell Assistant Food and Beverage Director. We recommend wash down the Ajax truffle fries with a glass of the aforementioned Veuve Clicquot Parsaden yellow label champagne, a pint of Dry Dock apricot blonde ale brewed in Aurora, Colorado, or a swill of the turmeric ginger hot toddy mixed with Basil Hayden bourbon. TheLittleNell.com. Snack. The White House Tavern. try the Honor Burger, a juicy helping of fresh ground chuck layered with white cheddar, tomato, and spicy slaw. AspenWhiteHouse.com. Meat and Cheese Restaurant and Farm Shop. Try the Biscuit Board, a mouth-watering compilation of flaky buttermilk biscuits, shaved ham, and house-made seasonal mustard. MeatCheese.AvalancheAspen.com. And finally, French Alpine Bistro, Crêperie du Flige. Try the Cheese Fondue, a camaraderie of melted Gruyère, Vacherin, Beaufort, and Comte, with white wine and Kirschwasser, served with crisp bread slices. FrenchAlpineBistro.com. P.S. The Aspen Food and Wine Classic takes place this year, June 19th to 21st. Rolling on the River. When he takes his son rafting out west before sending him off to college back east, a father learns to let it flow. By Jordan Rain. See those two scary-looking rocks down there on the right? Those are what we call the goalposts. We need to go between them, not hit them. If we hit either of those two goalposts, Kylie, our river rafting guide, lets the sentence hang before our first rapid this morning like an errant barrel on the edge of Niagara Falls. Enough said. We get it. Don't hit the post. It's a simple enough directive for, say, a hockey player or field goal kicker on flat, delineated terra firma. Less so, it turns out, for a half-dozen helmeted humans clutching paddles aboard a raft hurling down a tilted stretch of whitewater named the Quarter Mile of Chaos, booby-trapped with a pair of fast-approaching, game-deciding goalpost boulders. When the whirling current swings us slightly off course, and then, backward, squooch, the inevitable occurs. The side of our raft grinds into one of those dreaded craggy uprights. So what exactly happens when you hit the post on Colorado's capricious Cache la Poudre River? The usual chaos. Our boat high sides, rearing up on one end, splash! A crew member tumbles out of our listing vessel and into the drink, while the rest of us barely hang on to our suddenly verticalish seats. Then, whoomp! A raft from behind plows into our stalled vehicle, loses its own footing in the relentless current, flips over, and turns its entire crew of neoprene warriors into scattered swimmers down a frigid, not-so-lazy river. All just like that, in a matter of seconds. What occurs next, thankfully, is a testament to the sort of quick, chaos-quelling river guide choreography one can only hope was included somewhere in that liability waiver. Yanking our ejected passenger out of the water and back into the boat like a 180-pound stray kitten, while barking naval officer-style paddling commands at the rest of us. Kylie manages to free our stuck vessel and steer us to the opposite bank, out of harm's way. Meanwhile, amidst a volley of whistles, hand signals, and various other efficient rescue ops above the blaring rapids, a hustling team of guides positioned downriver has almost as quickly recovered the upended boat and plucked its lost crew out of the current. After a rough start on the Poudre, order has been restored and the world appears to be reasonably afloat again. Bobbing off on the sidelines by the far bank, our own drenched, wide-eyed crew members are busy catching our breath, bailing excess adrenaline, and quietly determining if we're all having fun yet. "So, where's everybody from?" our buoyant guide asks us. brief time out and light riverside chit-chat dispensed with, we push off again, heading back onto the field. The current takes hold. We pick up speed and turbulence. Game on. Forward paddle, Kylie barks as we all dig into the river, pushing to a bumpy gallop like the brave Western expeditionary force we're not. Never mind that little hiccup back there. Now we're definitely having fun. Okay, see that bridge ahead? Kylie says, a few rapids later. That's called Killer Bridge. We need to avoid the middle post on that bridge. If we hit that middle post... Nothing kicks off summer quite like a splashy river adventure in the perfect place at the perfect time with the perfect company. Just ask those guys from Deliverance. Or consult my then 17-year-old son Jackson, who agreed to run a pair of carefully chosen Colorado rivers with me last June before heading off to college. In a couple of short months, he'd be paddling off on his own to some faraway land called Connecticut, a mere 3,000 miles from his shell-shocked parents back home in California, wondering how all this happened so fast. But let's not go there just yet. The 5-day plan. Touch down in Denver and drive a big, beautiful loop through the mountains and high plains of northern Colorado via Steamboat Springs and Fort Collins. The two highlights. A couple of rafting trips down some whitewater beauties, Steamboat's Elk River and Fort Collins' Cache la Poudre River. More on that last name later. Both are perfectly timed in the wake of an epic winter for some of the biggest water either of these snow-melt-fed rivers has seen in years. The one ulterior motive, subjecting my college-bound kid to at least one more Wild West thrill ride with his old man before he whooshes off in all those other heart-rending directions, east, adulthood, etc. How cool is this? Jackson says during our scenic westward drive through the Colorado Rockies en route to Steamboat Springs. Very cool. In fact, downright freezing with heavy winds and increasingly limited visibility. Barely an hour ago, as we rolled out of Denver along Interstate 70, it was a cloudless 80-degree day. Exiting the far side of the lofty Eisenhower Tunnel at the Continental Divide, we're suddenly in a snowstorm at 11,158 feet. Winter, it appears, isn't quite over in Colorado mountain country. In fact, we just heard that Steamboat Springs got dumped with nearly 2 feet of fresh powder a couple of days ago on the first day of summer. That's where we're supposed to be going rafting tomorrow. It's all good, Jackson says, tempering his mission-focused dad and enjoying the fine novelty of a summer blizzard like anyone raised in L.A. should. If we don't go running rivers, we can always just go snowboarding. We veer north and the fickle mountain weather pulls another abrupt turn. The snow shrinks into rain, then vanishes altogether. Soon the sky is a deep Colorado blue, and our two-laner back road cuts through a warm emerald canvas of broad hills and valleys, accented with old cattle fields, an unexpected winery or two, and a very homemade-looking campaign of hand-painted roadside ads plunked in the middle of nowhere for a Western wear company up ahead called FM Light and Sons. Cowboy hats for the whole family. Then the rivers begin to appear, serious ones. First we drive across the upper Colorado, all glimmering navy and yet unhampered by those dams and thirsty states waiting below. Then we meet the Yampa River, running its own wild 250-mile course, including straight through downtown Steamboat Springs, tucked on the northwest edge of the state. By the time we arrive in Steamboat, a.k.a. Ski Town, USA, the fabled ranching community turned famed winter playground appears to have quickly recovered from its 20-inch dusting on June 21st. Today, the only traces of snow here are on its giant, empty ski hills hulking just outside of town. Everywhere else, the grass is green, the breeze is warm, and summer has arrived in the nick of time. A lot of folks will tell you that summer is their favorite time to be in Steamboat, says Laura, a friendly local checking us in at the Rabbit Ears Motel, situated right beside the rumbling Yampa River and a few short blocks from the town's summer rodeo grounds. Yeah, we're Ski Town, USA, but Steamboat is, and hopefully always will be, a warm, laid-back cowboy town at heart, she adds. You guys picked the perfect time to come visit us. As its name and selfie-bait neon-grinning bunny sign out front suggests, the Rabbit Ears Motel, a true local landmark that opened its doors in 1952, a full decade before the neighboring ski resort was launched, isn't aspiring to be any Ritz-Carlton Vail. Clean, cozy, quirky, and fittingly down-to-earth in a town with the same enduringly glitz-free reputation, the hotel's magnum opus is its row of river view rooms, positioned as close to the raising Yampa as a guest could ever want without snorkel and a life jacket. It's actually the perfect white noise to drown out your snoring, Jackson says, cranking open the sliding patio door, mere steps from the river, and flooding our river room with a pounding natural soundtrack of liquid thunder. Hey, do you want to check out the town? I ask him, sliding gracefully into a type A journalist father mode. I'll catch up with you in a bit, Jackson says, flopping onto the bed closest to the river. I think I'm just going to shut my eyes for a few minutes. Do you know why this place is called Steamboat Springs? I counter, artfully luring him back into the story. I don't, Jackson says, promptly falling asleep. The origins of the name Steamboat Springs, as local legend has it and your teenage kids couldn't care less about, can be attributed to a trio of mid-19th century French fur trappers. Camping on the banks of the Yampa River, they heard a rhythmic chugging sound downriver that they somehow mistook for an approaching steamboat. The sound, it turned out, was coming from one of numerous active mineral hot springs in the area, loudly belching steamy water out of the earth. You know, very much like a giant steamship scooting impossibly through the Rocky Mountains. But the name stuck. Today, those thermal waters, discovered more than 500 years ago by Ute Indians who settled along the Yampa, are savored year-round by locals and visitors alike at popular steamy, multi-pooled haunts like Old Town Hot Springs, right across from Rabbit Ears, and Strawberry Park, a secluded mineral springs retreat up in the hills above town. Joining a flow of early summer visitors through Steamboat's main drag along Lincoln Avenue, I notice more boogie art galleries, all organic cafes, sushi counters, and requisite North Face and Marmot stores than during my last visit here many moons ago. All refreshing enough, but it's good to see the town's oldest, boldest retailer, F.M. Light & Sons, outfitting the West for over 100 years, still holding court in the heart of downtown, housing enough boots, cowboy hats, and every other form of Western regalia to dress half the state. The splashiest recent facelift in town is down by the river, along a revitalized stretch of Yampa Street dubbed Restaurant Row. The formerly barren river bank is now lined with crowded farm-to-fork bistros, upscale chop houses, a microbrewery housed in a former utilities building now serving up wood-fired pizzas and arugula salads, and a Rockin' on the River free summer concert series stage, where a local band is jamming through an extended version of that old fish crowded pleaser, Possum. Locals stand on the grass. Kids and parents pedal past on bikes along a new paved river trail. Spandexed joggers breeze by with their chocolate labs as a golden sun sets over the Yampa. Welcome to the new steamboat. I text Jackson. He should see this. It's already been a couple of hours since his power nap. Hey, I'm rocking on the river. Want to grab a bite? Still asleep, he texts back. How early do we need to be up tomorrow? Cut to later the next morning, or way too early the next morning if you're under 20. Jackson and I are being fitted into medium-sized neoprene rental duds for river trip number one. When he trades his in for a large, it's official. My son has outgrown me. Gearing up in a woodsy clearing north of Steamboat on the Elk River in Rout National Forest, Jackson seals the deal. Here you go, he says, handing me the shorter paddle. Sure, rub it in. Our rafting rides today, Chris, Jeff, and Alex from Bucking Rainbow Outfitters are stoked. The Steamboat-based company runs trips down a bunch of big rivers during prime rafting season in May and June, including the Yampa and the Colorado. But the Elk River, a lively-looking tributary of the Yampa, is unquestionably the place to be today. I've never seen it nearly this high by late June, and it's definitely the longest continual rapids I've ever run, Chris says. There will not be a single break between here and our takeout 7 miles downriver. It's Class 3 boogie water the whole way. How are you guys feeling? Are we ready to do this? Yeah, booms a chorus of about 20 rafters converged on a secluded riverbank rumbling in the upper Colorado hills from seemingly everywhere else. Chicago, North Carolina, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, etc., along with a couple of stray Californians, or at least one of them not yet fully awake. We'll have about 2,600 cubic feet per second of 40-degree river current powering us today, Jeff bellows during a short, mandatory safety briefing. One CFS equals approximately one chicken per second. So these rapids are 2,600 chickens. Can anyone compete against that many freezing cold chickens per second? No, says the chorus. So rule number one, Alex chimes in. If you fall out of the boat and become a swimmer, do not try to stand up or challenge the chickens. They will win every time. Rule number two, those fallen logs and branches in rushing water are called strainers, because anything that flows through them gets turned into pasta. So if you're a swimmer, you definitely want to swim away from the strainers. A few more delightful rules later, and the tag team pep talk is done. Does anyone still want to go? Chris quips. Anybody nervous? Jeff says. A few honest hands in the crowd go up. I turn to Jackson. It's his first time rafting, and I still haven't fully recovered from a harrowing whitewater misadventure in Costa Rica at a friend's destination wedding years ago. I'll raise my hand if you do, I whisper to my large, sleepy rafting partner, who doesn't take the bait. There's no easy start here, Chris says, climbing into the stern while pushing our raft out into the rumbling river. We're going to be flying right off the bat. A second later, we're flying all right, straight toward a bouldered ledge of water. Down goes the bow of our boat, along with Jackson seated up front, dunked into a glassy wall of shockingly cold river. When he reemerges from his baptism, Jackson is soaked, wide-mouthed, and beaming like the child he suddenly no longer is. and it's in that tender moment, witnessing, from the relative safety of one row back, my son's temporary reverse metamorphosis from stubbled, deep-voiced, perma-sleep-deprived dude to giddy-faced kid that I grasp what middle-aged parental happiness truly is. Seeing the gleeful look in your 17-year-old's eyes on a sunny northern Colorado day in June after he gets thumped with a face full of 40-degree water on the Elk River. Jackson shakes it off, smiling ear to ear, now fully awake as our raft fumbles through a rock garden of ceaseless rapids and straight into another tumbler that soaks the rest of us. Forward two! Two more! Back three! One more! Chris directs from behind, steering us through another rough patch that could have gone more smoothly. I'll be honest with you guys, Chris says of our developing Elk River paddling skills. That was pretty bad. Let's try that again. Forward two. It takes several sustained miles of practice, but eventually we get there. Okay, now you're crushing it, Chris tells us as we slalom through a collision course of downed logs, miscellaneous strainers, and a low-lying bridge that has us all ducking just in case. Last week, he tells us, the river was so high that it was unrunnable for anyone but kayakers with the hardest heads. Thick forests of pine and aspen bounce by. Hawks soar overhead. It's a long, idyllic 7 miles of continuous rapids to our tricky takeout point, hiding just around the next bend. But nearing the funkyish finish line, who actually wants this to end? We got to be on our game here, guys, Chris coaches as we slide ambivalently toward our parking spot, a tight bank followed by miles of more rapids. If we miss this stop, it's a long way to Utah. A prez raft? That may not be an official term, but if you were to coin it after a morning of thrills and sufficient chills on the Elk River, it really ought to include a hearty thaw in those geothermal waters that gave Steamboat Springs its name. Soaking at Strawberry Park Hot Springs, an iconic oasis of mineral pools tucked in the hills just north of town, on the edge of the Yampa Valley, it has been a time-honored winter apres ski ritual for decades. So why not for early summer river runners? As we wind up a dirt road to the secluded springs on a 78-degree afternoon, past a lone deer crossing our path, a homemade drive slowly, mom and baby moose sign, and minefields of giant potholes, I figure we'll have the whole steamy place to ourselves and the resident ungulates at this transitional time of year. Until entering the Strawberry Park lot, stuffed with cars and Sweet Pea Tours buses. I think the secret may be out about this place, Jackson remarks. We head up a little footpath to the springs and enter a natural amphitheater brimming with soaking sybarites of all ages, melting away in a multi-tiered set of stony pools tucked between rustling aspens and a babbling creek in the hills. Picturesque and packed. I'll just chill up here, Jackson says, passing on the whole public bathing experience and settling for a deck chair away from the throng of human lobsters. But you go ahead. I go ahead, wading into those 104-degree springs, accompanied by a swirling mountain breeze and looping zen soundtrack of trickling water from all sides. Closing my eyes, still the best way to make everyone else disappear, I instantly drift into a pure, dumb contentment. And I'll tell you, because I know you can keep it to yourself, Jackson doesn't know what he's missing. What's in a name? On the Cache de la Poudre, Colorado's one and only nationally designated wild and scenic river, you can bet there's a fun little fable about how this singular thread of water tumbling 7,000 feet from the Rocky Mountains to the Great Plains, came to be labeled with a curious French phrase. And you can also be 100% certain that during a gorgeous eastward drive to Fort Collins along State Highway 14, a Colorado scenic and historic byway featuring a spectacular river gorge, your teenage son doesn't need you to regale him with it. It was named by traveling French-Canadian fur trappers in the early 1800s, who were forced to stash their gunpowder here, or cache la poudre, during a snowstorm. I uncontrollably elucidate as we drive through a blasted-out tunnel in the canyon. "Cool," Jackson autoplies, staring out at some rafts bouncing down a lively set of rapids on a historic river now simply called the Poudre, by all stripes of recreationists naturally drawn to this dramatic spot. "We'll be paddling these waters tomorrow morning." "I like Poudre better," Jackson says before turning to me with mild concern. "So how early do we need to get up tomorrow?" Down in Fort Collins, the river reappears as a tame waterway at the gates of the plains, Colorado State University, and an attractive college town flowing with factoids I don't bug my 17-year-old with just yet, more than 20 craft breweries, 7 distilleries, and enough zany-named bars, Poor Brothers, Illegal Pete's, Avuncular Bob's Beer House, etc., to satiate a community several times its moderate size. "This place must be very fun in September," Jackson muses, as we explore Old Town Foco's surplus of indie shops and mandatory retro stops, including Pinball Jones, a basement hall stuffed with pinball machines. After noshing on some superb seafood on College Avenue, at least 1,000 miles from any ocean, we settle into our sleek downtown digs at the recently opened Elizabeth Hotel, where every room is furnished with a turntable and selection of classic LPs. Yes, including John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Double Fantasy, Ted Nugent's State of Shock, and Sugarloaf's Spaceship Earth. "Which one should I put on?" I ask Jackson. "You choose," he says, diving for his AirPods. Early the following morning, after a deja vu waiver signing, melancholy father-son wetsuit fitting, and sobering safety intro, hosted by a team of psyched river guide jesters, "Everyone still want to go?" with local outfitter A. Wanderlust Adventure, we're back in the saddle with a paddle on the Poudre. This time, I'm joining Jackson in the very front. "See those two scary-looking rocks down there on the right?" says our rafting guide, Kylie, as we set out on our first gnarly rapid. "It's the highest this river has been in late June in years. Those are what we call the gold posts." Well, you know what happens next. Our next big gauntlet runner on the river is, you may recall, nicknamed Killer Bridge. "This is the most dangerous part of the trip," Kylie tells us, as we slowly glide into the side of a small bridge, crossing the river with an ominous post in the center. "We need to avoid that middle post at all costs. If we hit it, the boat can taco." Kylie then explains what tacoing means. It doesn't sound too good. We definitely do not want to taco. Kylie, a CSU senior, turns to Jackson, a college freshman in a couple of months. "In a year, you'll be old enough to come back here and be a guide," she says to him. "We get through this bridge, and you'll have my official recommendation. Forward paddle." Jackson digs into the current. I follow his lead toward Killer Bridge, coming at us faster and faster. I glance over at my son one last time, his bright eyes wide open with a trace of a smile. We should be fine.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by Music and Memories at 1.